Welcome back, and I'm here with John Mitchell. Now we're going where most viewers love to live, that intersection of lifestyle goals and financial planning and reducing, once again, their largest expense, taxes, right? But tax strategy isn't a trick, okay? It's an alignment between how you earn, how you spend, and how you structure it. So today I want to talk a little bit about proactive planning, entity decisions, timing, bookkeeping, and avoiding this strategy theater that we see here all over the Instagram and all over the socials, where all of a sudden, you know, it's almost like, John, it's almost like when the cat's away, the mouse will play, and we're starting to get these ideas that are really far out there, right? So how do we maybe not live on the edge there, but still accomplish what we want to accomplish here? So for business owners, what's the biggest structure mistake that you see is when they go to choose what entity and how they set up their business?
Right. You know, one of the things I've seen several times is people, you know, they think they need, they hear something on TikTok or, you know, TikTok University, we call it, or, you know, sometimes, you know, whatever the seminar or whatever they went to, or maybe a friend of a friend told them this, and they set up an S Corp. And S Corp can be a very powerful and very effective way to make sure that you minimize your tax burden, but it's got to be done in the right way, and it's got to be done at the right time, right? So I tell people, just as a general rule of thumb, an S Corp can be good for you, for example, if you are well into the six figures, right? If you have a business that you just started last year and you're, you know, pulling in $40,000, $50,000, $60,000, not time to do an S Corp yet, first of all. And secondly, a lot of times what people do with the S Corp, you know, the S Corps cause a lot of trouble because people don't realize that you have to do reasonable compensation, mm-hmm. right? So the regulations require that if you're going to have an S Corp, the advantage of the S Corp is, let's say you netted after all your expenses $200,000, right? If you were on a Schedule C, that whole $2,000 goes on your personal tax return, and you pay not only federal tax on that, but you also pay Social Security and Medicare tax, right? And so one of the things you can do with an S Corp is split that up, and you can say, okay, I'm going to put myself on payroll, and I'm going to receive $100,000 worth of payroll, and the other $100,000 is going to be a distribution from the business to me. It would be as if, and it's not, don't take this literally, so it's not exactly a dividend, but it would be something similar to a dividend. Mm-hmm. So you take $100,000, so you make that same $200,000 as an S Corp, pay yourself a salary of $100,000, the other $100,000 you pay it to yourself as a distribution. Distribution does allow you to go ahead and take that, pay that, federal income tax, but you miss out on paying all the self-employment tax that you would pay. So $100,000 in that example, it would be a little over around $15,000 that you would, $14,000 that you would, that you'd be paying in extra. So it can save you money, but only if you do it right. Because if you do not pay yourself a reasonable compensation, then you're going to get into a reasonable compensation audit, and things are going to start getting recharacterized, and you're going to end up with a big bill at the end of the day.
So not only does it help protect against audit, it's what you're supposed to be doing. A lot of people are just taking distributions rather, so just so that they cannot pay that payroll tax that's in there, right? But also it's going to affect things such as like 401k or the ability to put together a pension plan. Is that right?
That is correct. Yeah. Because, you know, you need to have the income to be able to put income away in a tax deferred type of vehicle, like a 401k or an IRA or whatever it may be. Yeah.
Yeah. And, you know, we talked a little bit. I assume that before you set up an S Corp, if your business isn't large enough, would that just be a sole proprietorship and it would flow through very similar to an S Corp?
You know, the easiest way you can do it is to set up a sole proprietorship, and that way you got yourself a nice Schedule C, which is just a piece of paper that you attach to your tax return, your 1040, and it says how much money came in and how many deductions and what was the net, and then that gets carried forward and added into all your other income sources. And so that's the simplest way. Now, a lot of something that I can mention that a lot of people don't realize is, you can have an LLC, limited liability company, mm-hmm. and report that on a Schedule C on your tax return. Mm-hmm. So you can do that because an LLC, tax-wise, is not its own thing. It's like a chameleon, right? Like yeah. It can have, it can be this color or that color, right? Yeah. So an LLC can be taxed either as if it's a sole member, then it can be taxed on a Schedule C. It can be a partnership if there's more than one, or it can be taxed as a corporation, be that a C-Corp or S-Corp tax. Mm-hmm. So LLCs are adaptable, in the tax world, and you can pay taxes on your LLC in different ways.
Yeah, yeah. And let's talk about the other end of the entity structure. Let's talk about C-Corps. These things were a dying breed here, and now with QSBS here, if you're looking to sell a company, it might make sense to go and create a C corporation or maybe even a subchapter C and do an F reorg on this. Are you finding that C corps are starting to become more popular in this world of mergers and acquisitions that we've been in the last couple years?
Yeah, I would say so. C corps they had waned a little bit, and they're kind of coming back a bit nowadays. Yeah, some of the advantages, if you talk about C corp versus S corp, S corp is restricted in the number of shareholders it can have. As S corp is restricted in the types of shareholders that you can have. Like for example, no foreign shareholders. But a C corp doesn't have any of those restrictions. Also, a C corp can have different classes. You can have preferred versus common stock, and S corp cannot do that. And so, an S corp is really a tax advantaged type of thing that you can do if you're a small family, let's say family corporation, right? Mm-hmm. A C corp, if you want to actually build up a business and you're going to sell shares in it and maybe even go public, then you definitely want to go the C corp route.
Yeah. Obviously, it seems like S corp, you're not going to get taxed twice, maybe a little bit easier to set up. But as we're looking at a large exit event, talking to somebody like you and evaluating the pros and the cons of this move, something that's at least worth a conversation there. So wonderful. Hey, let's get back here. Let's talk about audit resiliency. And when we're looking at deductions, what can I claim legally as a deduction without living in fear? How far do you like to see your clients push the envelope? Because there's a gray area there. And a lot of CPAs like to stay away from the gray area. Where do you like to live in this gray area?
I like to do the very best result for my client that I can, right? And I am well aware that I personally am comfortable pushing things a little further than probably a lot of other tax professionals might want to push things, right? But of course, never pushing it past the critical point, right? You gotta make sure that you are within the bounds of the law, and I'm not going to do anything illegal, unethical, or even immoral or fattening, right? So I'm gonna stay away from all that. But Code Section 162. Is in the Internal Revenue Code, and that's the section that talks about deductions being and one of the main things about deductions, it has to be an ordinary and necessary business expense for you to be able to deduct it, right? Mm-hmm. And the courts have come along with they've kind of honed down on what that means, right? Basically, ordinary and necessary means business expenses that are helpful in being able to maintain your business and keep being able to help you produce more money within your business, right? And so if you think about, one of the things about people try and deduct clothing, well, look, I need my $2,500 suit because I got to look good, because if I don't look right, then the clients aren't going to pay me what I'm worth, yada, yada, right? That's probably, you know, most likely not going to work. But anything that's ordinary and necessary, like in my business, I pay half my cell phone bill out of the business, because I'm half the time that I'm on my cell phone, at least half the time is a business call. So that's a thing, you know. Gasoline, we prorate that in my household. Part of it's a business because, truth be told, right? We're out there going to the bank. We're going to, events, whatever. We're going out to meet a client at their place of business. So I have plenty of, auto expenses, but it's just, you got to be reasonable, and you got to make sure that you document things well. And that's usually going to keep you out of trouble.
Yep. And if the IRS, correct me if I'm wrong, but if you get an agent or an officer that looks and they go to audit and you come back with all the documentation, they're probably going to say, hey, this person's wrapped up. Let's close this file out as quickly as we can and maybe go to the person who's not as prepared. Is that fair?
I have seen that happen. Yeah, sure.
Yeah. Awesome. Well, hey, let's talk about timing here. Income recognition, expenses, big purchases, retirement contributions. I'm Alan Franks, host of Frankly Speaking, only on Now Media Television. We're here with one goal and one goal only. Our aim is to solve any business owner problem, anywhere, anytime. Join me for my next episode of Frankly Speaking, only on Now Media Television. Where are people missing the window on this?
You know, it's not the same to pay your business expense on January 2nd as it was to pay it on December 30th. I'll say that, right? So part of what we do with planning in the last couple of months of the year, I'll send out a little reminder notice to my clients and say, hey, if you got any big expenses coming up that you already, I'm not saying spend money that you wouldn't have otherwise spent, right?
Yes. That's the tail wagging the dog. G-wagon. Don't go get the G-wagon because the Instagram said go get the G-wagon as a business deduction, okay? Don't let the tax tail wag the dog here. Thank you. Sorry for interrupting. It's just, we get a lot of ideas. Oh, I could go get a private jet. Well, yeah, you could, but should we? Should we? It is a deduction. We can bonus depreciate it. But should we? Go ahead, John. I'm sorry.
Right. No, that's exactly where I was headed with that. Yeah. So don't let the tax tail wag the financial dog, so to speak. Right.
Yeah.
So if it's money that you were already going to spend and you thought you might spend that money in January or February, well, I mean, you can go ahead and spend it in November or December. I mean, as long as you've got it and as long as you were going to spend it anyway, and that's going to move your deduction up. And that's going to be, better. And I've even in my own life, I've moved. So you can do that with deductions. You can also do it with income. Are you okay if we do this project in January versus December? Yeah, sure. That's fine, John. I don't need it, till a couple of months later, actually. All right. Good. Let's sign the contract and let's get the money in January rather than December. And that pushes my ultimate tax consequences off, quite a bit, until next year. So, you can play those kinds of games. You can also do bunching, right? So let's say you are planning, you have a commitment that you've made, right? I'm gonna give away 5%, or I'm gonna give away 10% of my net income to charity, right? Well, you can do that every year, right? 10%, 10%, 10%, or you can do 20% 1 year and 0% the other. And, you know, if you run the calculations, you're going to have a spreadsheet and figure this out. But if it's advantageous, you can end up over a period of years giving the same amount of money, but you can bunch them up in such a way that it will make advantageous, it'll give you tax advantages for doing it that way.
That's right. And what we're really talking about here, John, is something called time-weighted rate of return, right? Let's say that your income is the same in 25 as it is in 2026. You'll still get the same rough deduction whether you do it on December 30th or January 1st. It's just, when do you get that deduction? Is it going to be this April? So if you do it in December, it's going to be this April, you know, 4 or 5 months away, right? But if you do it in January, it's going to be the following April here. We're talking about 16 months, right? Deduction is probably going to be the exact same here, but it's the time-weighted rate of return on that deduction, which is why I spent a lot of money the last 5 days of December. Try to pay everything.
Yes, sir. Yeah, you and a lot of other people. Yeah.
That's right. That's right. Well, hey, what I love about talking with you is how you make the complex simple here. What's one strategy, concept you wish every entrepreneur understood?
You know, oh my God, there's so many, but, you know, one of the things that I could recommend for people is to actually kind of get a grip on this stuff and understand that planning is not a last minute thing. You should be constantly doing that. And again, I would just reiterate, we already mentioned this, but reiterate, it's better to get a tax professional involved sooner rather than later, because, you know, some things, you know, the time runs out on your ability to do something with it. But if you get somebody involved early on, you can make a plan. It's a marathon, not a sprint, and you can make sure that you're able to take full advantage, whereas you might have lost out on things if you waited.
Yeah. And along those lines, what is the clearest connection that you see between tax strategy and long-term independence?
You know, taxes, as you said at the very beginning of the show, right? Taxes is one of the biggest, maybe the biggest expense that you're going to have as a business person. And so if you get a handle on that expense, I mean, that, you know, one good tax strategy can save you more money than buying the cheap coffee for the break room rather than the good coffee, right?
That's right.
So, you know, tax planning can have a big, make a big difference. And, you know, if you talk to anybody like in the financial planning, you know, realm, they're going to tell you about cumulative effects of things, right?
Yeah.
So I might be able to save a little extra money in 1 year, but what is the cumulative effect of that over 5 or 10 years?
Yes.
It's going to be huge. It's, you know, you're getting into, you know, eighth wonder of the world type stuff, like compound interest and stuff, right? So, you know, a little difference can make a bigger difference in the long run.
Yeah, you got it, right? And I feel like a lot of people are focused in on $10 problems instead of $10,000 problems. And the same way with solutions, right? Okay, we're focusing on how to get cheaper coffee in the break room here, where there's some strategies that you may or may not have known about that could really save significant money. And you just mentioned something that is so important. In my opinion, John, feel free to correct me, but every single tax strategy carries some level of risk. Even we talked earlier about the lunch that we go out, that's clearly business purposes here, still contains a little bit of risk. Low risk, yet still risk here, right? And then there's some tax strategies on a scale of 1 to 10 that are going to be higher on that. What's so important, in my opinion, is that whatever we save on our tax strategies, that we reinvest it. Because we don't know, it might be 4, 5, 6, as you mentioned, years in the future where Uncle Sam comes a knock in, audits, hey, we owe taxes, back penalty or penalties, back interest, right? And it really, hey, if you took those tax savings and went and spent it on your lifestyle, you could be in a very bad position. But if we took those tax strategies and geared those towards long-term wealth creation, you know, hopefully at that point, we might have even made enough money to pay for all that stuff, right? So, great. Well, hey, coming up in our final segment, I want to ask John about tax court, high stakes mistakes, and how families can protect their legacy when taxes and legal exposures collide. I'm Alan Franks, host of Frankly Speaking, only on Now Media Television. We're here with one goal and one goal only. Our aim is to solve any business owner problem, anywhere, anytime. Join me for my next episode of Frankly Speaking, only on Now Media Television. Welcome back to Frankly Speaking. Don't miss a second. Now Media TV streams live and on demand. Download the free Now Media TV app on Roku or iOS and listen to the podcast version anytime at nowmedia.tv. For now, I'm back with John Mitchell. In our final segment, we've covered tax strategies here, IRS pressure, and proactive planning. Now I want to talk about protection, because wealth isn't just what you build, it's what you keep, it's what you defend, it's what you pass forward to the next generation with clarity. So what I want to talk about here is legacy resistance, avoiding these catastrophic mistakes that really set us back here, and building systems that protect us over time, that protect our money, that protect our relationships. So for someone who's never dealt with tax court, John, what's the clean difference between an IRS appeals and tax court, and when does that conversation shift?
Right. Well, you know, if you start looking at the statistics, and the IRS publishes these, by the way, every year. But you start looking at statistics, you see that most tax controversies, and when I say controversies, I mean one of two types of things, right? Either it's an exam issue, so they're trying to disallow deductions or impute income that you don't feel is correct, and so you raise that as a dispute. Or it can be a collection type dispute, right? So it's either examination dispute or collection dispute. And the very first thing, the first level of elevation after you are, let's say you're in an audit with a revenue agent, or let's say you're in a collection case with a revenue officer, and you are not getting anywhere with them, you talk to the manager, a manager's not getting you any results, the very next step in the process, either way, is to go to the Independent Office of Appeals. Now, about 90% or so of disputes are resolved either at the Office of Independent Office of Appeals or below, right? So 9 out of 10 issues get fixed either in appeals or below the level of appeals. And appeals is your best friend within the IRS, right? I say that as a former appeals officer, right? Back in the day, I didn't care, you know, as long as you can justify that you're right, I will write up the opinion and we'll get you the adjustments made on your tax account. And I don't care if the IRS walked away with less money, right? I want to get to the right result, and I want to be fair and make sure that we, make sure that we really drive home that sense of fairness so that people can be in voluntary compliance in their taxes, right? That's the mission. And so that was really at the top of my mind. Now, when you talk about tax court, things that don't manage to get settled at the appeals level, they go on to litigation. And the biggest forum for litigation is the United States Tax Court. Now, you can end up in the Federal Court of Claims, or you can end up in Federal District Court. Some tax controversies are settled in the bankruptcy courts, but that's a very kind of relatively small, 2 or 3%, right? Most of the litigation takes place in the United States Tax Court, and that's what doesn't get solved in appeals, which is already, so it's a small percentage of a small percentage, right? But you'll find, I guess, the biggest difference, even though the Tax Court is intended to be and designed to be and functions as a kind of a friendly, you know, at the federal level, imagine like being in traffic court, or imagine being in, you know, justice of the peace or small claims court, right? It's not exactly Judge Judy, but it's not got all the formality and bells and whistles of like a federal district court, right? And so it's going to be kind of a forum that's made to be friendly for the taxpayers. About 70% of those cases are pro se, which means the tax taxpayer walks into court and represents themselves. And so the judges are kind of, there's no juries, it's only judges in tax court, and the judges are cognizant, or, and they understand, and they know that a lot of times you're going in there, facing off the lion's den on your own, right? But even so, you will find the tax court, yes, that's going to be a whole lot more formal of a setting than what I used to have, like in an appeals conference. So yeah. you'll definitely see the difference.
Yeah, well, you mentioned self-representation here. But let's talk about hiring representation. You've got a lot of letters after your name. And in our industry, we call those designations. What in the heck do they mean? Do you mind telling us what they mean and why they matter?
Okay, yeah, sure. I can jump into that. I'll tell you what, I got my oldest son is smart aleck that he is. You know, one day he's in my home office. He was looking over some, materials on my desk that I was preparing for some presentation, because I do a lot of public speaking, and I had a slide there, and he says, "Dad," he says, do you realize that there are more letters after your name than there are letters in your name?" And I said, "Well, I'll be darned. I look at that. I'm counting with my fingers and toes. I'm like, oh, holy crap, you're right. I guess there are. I have not counted it up like that, but thanks for pointing that out. Make me look more douchey than I am, right?" but let's see. So after my name, what do I typically put? LLB, so that means that's a bachelor in law. So that's my law degree. And then there is MST, that's Master of Science in Taxation. So that's a master's degree in taxes, just like it, like it sounds like. There is the EA, Enrolled Agent designation. There is USTCP, which is United States Tax Court Practitioner. Very happy and proud of that, because that's, like you said early on, the year that I took that exam, and I'm no genius, by the way, it took me 3 times to pass that exam, right? Yeah. So I took it until I passed it, right? But the third time was the charm, and 168 people took the exam nationwide, and 10 of us passed out of the 168. So that's about a 6% pass rate. NTPI is one of some of the letters after my name, National Tax Practice Institute. So I'm an NTPI fellow, which is a specialist. You go through a 2-year program. It's a specialist in representing people at the IRS. There's other, lesser things, but those are, I guess, are the main things. Am I leaving something out? Are you looking at a piece? I'm not looking at this.
No,
this
I'm
is not in front of me. So.
I'm just along for the ride.
I'm going by memory.
I actually didn't know that you had that many letters. I didn't realize that this question would take so long, actually. My gosh. Congratulations.
What I can say, sir, is that the tax business has been good to me, right? Yeah. It's a wonderful career, despite people rolling their eyes or whatever. It's very satisfying to me to be able to step up and kind of solve a puzzle and help people out. And so I just always keep looking for the next, the next designation.
You know, it's funny. I actually asked ChatGPT. So I've got young kids. Ask ChatGPT how one of my kids can become exactly what you are, right? I think it's a phenomenal intersection on the legal and the tax side. Very few people have that. It's very nuanced right there. And obviously people who have it are in high demand. So it's amazing. I'm just blessed that you're sharing your time with us here today. So a couple more questions. We're going to wrap up here. I'm Alan Franks, host of Frankly Speaking, only on Now Media Television. We're here with one goal and one goal only. Our aim is to solve any business owner problem, anywhere, anytime. Join me for my next episode of Frankly Speaking, only on Now Media Television. It's amazing, and I'm just blessed that you're sharing your time with us. here today. So a couple more questions. We're going to wrap up here. Hey, is there any – we're talking about, you know, the best defense is preventative. Unless you're on a football field, prevent defense like never works. But we're in the business world, right? So preventative, right? Are there any systems? Is there any checklists? Is there any, like, hey, make certain you avoid these one or two small mistakes that could snowball into five or six mistakes? Is there any, you know, kind of final advice as we're wrapping up here today to business owners?
Yeah, I mean, it's usually a good idea to keep your books and records in good order. Don't sit down in March and start adding up your bank statements and do stuff. I mean, you know, you really want to keep track of that on at least probably a quarterly, or at least even better than that, a monthly basis, right? So it's good to set the habit. You can even set a calendar reminder. Hey, you know, the first Saturday of every month, I'm going to sit down and open up QuickBooks. I'm going to pour up a giant mug of coffee. I'm going to, you know, make sure that all my books and records are up to date for the month, right? And so, and that's good from a tax perspective, but it's also good from a management perspective, yes, right? Just yes, so that you can keep your, you know, keep a finger on your pulse of your business there, right? So that's a good thing. Have good filing systems. You know, I have a binder that actually an actual three-ring binder. Yes, I'm that old. I have a three-ring binder with all the correspondence that comes in for my business. It's divided by, you know, it's got a 1 through 12 tabs on it. And so if somebody says, hey, that letter from back in May, I can go back to the May tab and flip through and I can find that letter. Yeah. And so, you know, these seem like super basic things. I'm sorry if they're too basic for everyone, but I mean, you know,
they could be as basic. I haven't ran into a single business owner that does what you're talking about, right? It's so basic and simple that nobody does it, right?
Yeah, so basic, nobody does it. Yeah, you know, I guess the modern version of that is to keep, you know, maybe folders on your computer's desktop that says correspondence or whatever. You can scan that in. I mean, no shade on any of that. In fact, I have folders in my desktop, and I've got all of my business's documentation there, the articles of incorporation, the bylaws, the annual report that we have to make to Secretary of State, you know, all that stuff, the W-9 for when I have to bill somebody, all that stuff is in there, and it's at your fingertips, right? And so that's, I guess it's just a matter of being organized.
Yeah, yeah. Well, great. Well, hey, ending this on a powerful note and on a positive note, a lot of people have anxiety when they think about Uncle Sam, the IRS, and just taxes in general. How do you train your clients to look at the relationship with the IRS, at their relationship with paying taxes, so that it's a little bit more mentally healthy, maybe, and doesn't necessarily weigh them down?
You know, knowledge is power, is the thing I'm going to say. And most of the times when people are afraid of something, they're afraid of the unknown, right? And so I would say spend that little bit of time up front, familiarize yourself, and get that professional help. And that's going to get you a long way down the road from being so nervous and scared of, you know, of what might happen with the IRS. I promise you, the IRS, 99.999% of the people out there, I mean, there might be an exception, but 99.999% of the people, IRS, I swear to you, is not out to get you, right? They're there to do a job, and if you make a good faith effort, you're probably going to be all right.
Wonderful. Great. It's so great to hear that they're not necessarily the boogeyman on this, right? As a matter of fact, they're there probably to help you, because if you're listening to this, you probably pay your taxes. They're out there to try to get the people that aren't, right? So,
right.
Perfect. So, hey, last thing here before I let you go, where can people follow you? Where can they watch you on Legal Talk with John Mitchell?
I mean, you know, you read off all the Now Media, you know, stuff, so they can find my clips on that. And, you know, also I've got a YouTube channel, Attorney John Mitchell, so it's youtube.com/ Attorney John Mitchell, and there's a lot of clips of me from Legal Talk and from other things that I've done, so that's a good one. That's probably, I guess, the main way. If people like to watch me on video, that's probably going to be the main way to do it.
John, thank you so much. I have so many takeaways from today. Hey, you know, just summarizing here, this is not an April 15th event. This is a full year event right here. We want to have systems and processes of bookkeeping and checking these things on a monthly basis so that if the IRS ever does come knocking, you've got the proof right there, and they're just going to go on to the next door right there. And you've talked to us about, hey, you know, when you get a letter in the mail from the IRS, it's probably okay. You don't, your heart doesn't need to sink. If it's got a green stamp on it, my gosh, make certain that you open it and you respond and you don't panic. You reach out to a professional like you that's been in the belly of the beast here, that's worked for their clients to help solve these problems with the IRS here. So I just want to thank you so much for your time here, your knowledge. It's been so fun having you here. And once again, my name's Alan Franks, and this is Frankly Speaking. I'll see you next time.